Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Saturday, August 2nd, 2003. Today's session is entitled, Trade Serving People, Not People Serving Trade. Session 5 of Proclaiming the Year of the Lord's Favor in Our Global Reality. Some New Visions for the Future of God's Earth and God's People. Presented by Jim Bowman, number BOJ 2003-05. Let's listen in.
WOA and then Africa.org, that's the Washington office on Africa. It's supported by a variety of denominational groups. The ELCA partially funds them, and the usually the director of the Division for Global Missions serves on its board. And they're an important resource for things related to Africa. The director of that office is incredibly, he's an Anglican priest who does just a wonderful, who spent a lot of his life in Africa and is very good on policy issues. Yesterday I intended to put this website up there. We talked about the Millennium Development Goals of the United Nations that has been set up. And if you want to track the progress on those goals, we talked about the progress. You may want to just check out the website occasionally to see what's there. It's just un.org/millenniumgoals. The last one here is something that I failed to mention all week long, and I really feel badly about that because this is sort of my job, you know, promoting this, but. This year in February, well, some of you may know that for a number of years there were yearly events in Washington called impact briefings that the church faith community participated in or planned it. And that just sort of, the interest sort of died down, and now for a number of years they haven't had them for a variety of reasons. This last year in February, we had what we call ecumenical advocacy days, and the focus was two, one on Africa issues and the other one on Middle East issues. Those are the two tracks. Because it was so well attended, we had over 300 people, and almost a third of them were Lutherans. We really did what I felt pretty good about the Lutheran turnout. Diane over here in the corner attended that, right, that event. And so we do have one graduate of the program among us. And because of the success of that event and the interest that broadened out of that, we are planning another event for next year, March, I believe it's the 5th through the 8th. If the 5th is on a Friday, then I'd write on those dates. But if you go to that website, you can get all the information as it's posted. And this time around, it's expanded. It will still be Africa. It will still be the Middle East. But it will also be Asia, more specifically Korea, issues relating to Korea. Also Latin America, with specific focus on Colombia. There will also be the Jubilee debt issue. There's a sort of a broad economic justice issue that will combine trade and debt cancellation issues. And then a more recent group that's joined us that we decided to sort of let in the door. We meet every 2 weeks to begin planning this event, because it just takes an incredible amount of time and energy to pull this off. The last group to come on board is anti-nuclear proliferation group. So there's the house is getting bigger and bigger all the time. So some of you may be interested in participating at that event. It's an ecumenical event. There will be worship services. It starts on a Friday evening. Saturday, Sunday, and Monday will be a day of advocacy on the Hill. So if some of you want to come to Washington that time of the year, we would encourage you to do so. So I'll mention that as well. And then, for those of you who are on your way out, if you were here yesterday and didn't get this a copy, I have two left. And if you think that that your congregation would like to have this in its library, this one sort of related to the topic yesterday, for an aid to end hunger, and it's the annual Bread for the World publication, and this is for 2001. So, are you saying you want it?
I would.
Okay, well, I won't auction them off.
Okay.
I'll let you.
I'll take one if you have an extra.
Yeah. And I'm sure you can contact, if you didn't get one and want a copy, Bread for the World would be glad to supply you with a copy. Oh, I also have more copies back in the office. I filled up my suitcase and I have no more room. So if you contact us at this, I think there's a way of contacting us through that website. I'll be glad to send out a copy. Annual report, Lutheran World Relief. And this is a new brochure talking about the work of the public policy that Lutheran World Relief is doing. And again, you might want to take some home, put it up on your board. Or, I don't know if churches have track racks anymore, or whatever we have. And we'll talk about, this gets more into what's going on today. So maybe we can officially start for the recording if the person back there is still listening. I do have one more thing. The issue of HIV/AIDS came up and a couple times in the lectures or the classes this week. But next week is when we're going to spend a whole session on that. And this is one of the books that I've asked that the bookstore order, and they were able to get it. It's a marvelous book, and I just mentioned it for those of you who are on your way out. You may want to run up and get a copy. It's basically a book of black and white photographs and stories that looks like it's all, the photographs are wonderful, but the stories that are told are the stories that relate. It's not one of those things where there's a text that just sort of happens to be illustrated by photographs. But the people in the photographs are the people who are actually telling these stories. It's a wonderful, wonderful, high-quality book. I've used it on World AIDS Day in our worship service, and had people read some of the story. Their stories by children, their stories by pastors. Very powerful narration by a pastor who was one of the first African pastors who came out and publicly admitted to being HIV positive. And so people who work with various issues related to that. So that is a commercial. Look at this if you when you're done, and if you like it, don't take this one. That's mine, but there are more up there, and it's not terribly expensive. Okay. I think that's it. The others are not very nice. We're going to talk about trade this morning, and that's such a big issue to get your hands around. And I'm not sure what is, as I was thinking about where we would start, it was difficult to know, because there's so many dimensions of trade. I think more and more I've been seeing articles in the newspaper, and I'll be using a couple of them shortly, that have been very recent, relating to some of the complications of trade policies as they currently exist. The terms that you may or may not be familiar that probably need to be defined, or you maybe see them used and wonder what they mean. It was a word that I wasn't familiar with when I came to Washington 4 years ago and started my work with Lutheran World Relief. The first term that I heard in this context was neoliberal economic policies. Neoliberal, I only connected that with theology. I didn't understand how that, I mean, that was a term I was familiar with sort of in theological work, but as far as economic policy, I didn't quite understand what that meant. It's sometimes just shortened to talk, the words are either a market system or a free market system. It's basically connected with what we, this is, a lot of this is an oversimplification, but it sort of has to be done that way. Free market, another word that's used to describe this is the Washington Consensus, which sort of gives you an idea of where the power and where all the decisions are being made when it comes to trade issues. But just most briefly defined, it refers to a set of both economic values, and that's important, values. Cynthia Moloveda would talk about it as myths, and we talked about that earlier in her book, Healing a Broken World, Globalization and God. But it's a set of economic values, but also institutions that have come into existence that are based on a belief or a conviction that there can be a total free market in which unregulated, and all these words sort of are important, that's why I'm going slowly here, in which unregulated competing economic relationships of individuals or businesses can lead to optimum good for all. The focus is on growth. So, in other words, if we can deregulate the markets and make them totally free, then everybody is going to benefit somehow in that process. And so and it's a strongly held belief that kind of came into not only popularity but implementation in the mid-80s with Margaret Thatcher coming into power in the UK and Ronald Reagan here and in this country. So the focus is on growth. The focus is on just removing all of the restrictions to trade, because that's what is getting in the way. If we can only do that, then, and have truly free trade, everybody's going to benefit. Now, the faith community, in its policy work and in its advocacy work, has been fairly critical of this system. And its critique is based on, well, it's based on several things, but our approach, Lutheran World Relief's approach, is looking at any system, and any policy that's in place, what is its impact on what we call the poor and the powerless? That's our perspective. If it's a system that's being proclaimed as something that's going to benefit all, or is a policy that is touted as a policy that is going to bring people out of poverty, the critique we have is, what is the effect on the poor and the powerless? And the answer was, or has been, primarily that this free market approach has really increased inequality in terms of, and disparity, and has also had some tremendous impacts in terms of ecological degradation around the world. We've talked about that in various pieces of that earlier. Something is got to be wrong when 1/5 of the world's population receives 80% of the global income of the world. I mean, that's the kind of disparity we're looking at. 1/5 of the world receives 80%. Something is wrong when 1.2 billion people in the world make less than $1 a day. And 2.8 billion people make less than $2 a day. So we're beginning sort of from the point of view of looking at the inequities and saying, maybe there's something wrong with the policy, trade policy, and we're trying to narrow our focus this morning to trade policies. And so that's what I thought would be most helpful for us. And where I would like to begin is begin with articles right out of I guess it's last black. We're already in August, aren't we? The last month's newspaper. This has to do with Uganda, and I think these are the stories that I think touch home for us. And I'll just read just selections from it. Kampala, Uganda. This is out of the Washington Post. The women sitting in rows of 30 leaned over the mounds of fabric, picking up one swatch at a time and guiding it under humming sewing machines. Disco music was thumping. The low white lights of the factory blazed. 8 hours into their long day, the women smiled weakly. I did nothing before this. I had nothing. I didn't even have any parents, said shy Rosie Arulo, 24, who explained that her parents died of AIDS last year. She then turned quietly back to her work, sewing a trendy black shirt with white stitching. All I had left was the appetite to work. On the eve of, this was the 6th of July now, but this was, on the eve of President Bush's 6-day, 5-nation trip to Africa, U.S. officials had been noting the progress made under a 3-year-old trade program that gives duty and quota-free incentives to export African-made products to the United States. But a frustrating problem is plaguing the leaders of Uganda's lively and hopeful economy. They set up factories to stitch clothing for the U.S. market, but do not use local fabric. The foreign-owned factory in Kampala is getting its cotton from China because Ugandan cotton is more than twice as expensive. Another new factory in town is importing its cotton from the United States. That leaves out Ugandan farmers who cannot compete with their counterparts from the United States, China, France, and other countries that subsidize agricultural production. Clothing factories such as the one employing Arulo have opened in Uganda and a half dozen other sub-Saharan nations, creating thousands of low-paying jobs. At first, the factories were praised for employing women from tiny villages across Uganda. Many of the women didn't even know how to flush a toilet or turn on a light switch, let alone use a sewing machine. Now they make clothing for Target and Sportif, along with Gap and REI that says, made in Uganda. But the low-end factory jobs are not lifting Ugandans out of poverty. And I'll skip ahead. But when educated and energetic entrepreneurs, of which there are many in Uganda, look at their economy, they see 20 cents an hour factory jobs producing $41.99 fleece jackets that few people in their country could ever dream of affording. They see African farmers earning pennies for pounds of coffee that yield millions of dollars for American and European companies once they are poured into foamy lattes. They see it as the story of Africa. Precious raw materials extracted from a continent rich with natural resources and yet suffering in extreme poverty. Ugandans hope to persuade Bush of a twofold solution: decreasing European and U.S. subsidies that cripple competition for African farmers, while funding educational and exchange programs and providing loans to help Africans use their natural resources to create finished products. The U.S. provided $3 billion in direct income subsidies to U.S. cotton farmers last year, according to the International Cotton Advisory Committee in Washington. Bush said he would cut subsidies if Europe would do the same, leaving Africans the victims of a stalemate, because of course neither one willing to do that. If we don't push Bush for this, then we will be slaves as we always have been, said John Legenda, senior advisor to Uganda's president, who has been lauded for liberalizing markets and encouraging Ugandans to start businesses. We want to make this message clear. We don't want aid or food dumping. What we want is to be able to produce our own products and sell them like every other functioning world economy. So that's just a part of that story out of Uganda.
Jim, could you interpret that a little bit?
Yes.
In connection with the Washington consensus? They're asking for the U.S. to quit subsidizing our, let's say, cotton growers or something. Does that fit the Washington consensus of unregulated and unsubsidized? I mean, So are they asking for us to go further in the direction that we started with the Reagan administration?
Well, yes, that's what they're saying. They're saying put your money where your mouth is. Yeah. I mean, because the reality, and this is what I didn't get into, it's basically, I mean, the free trade is a myth. It doesn't exist. And what I want you to do is what I want to argue for, I hope as it comes through later in what some of the materials maybe that you'll read argue for is the difficulties that both the free trade proponents what their agenda creates, the difficulties that even in its theoretical form creates. Basically, it doesn't take into account the need for some regulation and take into account the inequities. Mm-hmm. Yes, the assumption is just basically fallacious in my point of view. Mm-hmm. But even given that, the realities of the trade is anything but free. And the U.S. subsidy of cotton, for example, there's many U.S. subsidies, but based on this story, the U.S. subsidy of cotton shows the inequities that they are, because of that, Ugandan farmers who grow cotton can't even sell to people in their country who are manufacturing it. And of course, the ownership of the factories is another issue. The ownership of the factories in Uganda are not locally owned. Mm-hmm. That's the other piece of it. So it will. I think the other thing. This story, which is even more recent, and had a conclusion right before I left, has to do with. Are you familiar with the term dumping or, where? Well, it's connected with subsidies. So that if you have a surplus, you dump that surplus on developing countries in order to get rid of it. And then they experience, I mean, it's a little bit like that.
Dumping,
you sell
selling
below market costs.
Yeah, selling
your
for
production
less.
Costs.
Yeah, yeah, right, that's a better, thank you. It's selling below your production costs. Mm-hmm. Okay. This was the headline in the business section of the Washington Post on July 13th. And it's entitled, Free Trades, Muddy Waters, and it's a story about catfish. And it's, I think, very interesting, and again, I'll just read sections. A mess of catfish has been dumped on the U.S. market. More precisely, the dumping involved fish with whiskers from Vietnam, some of which may have been masquerading as the sort of catfish found in American waters. So says the U.S. Department of Commerce. In a ruling last month, the department agreed with U.S. catfish farmers and processors that the Vietnamese were selling frozen fish fillets at unfairly low prices. That's a mouthful, isn't it? Frozen fish fillets. Despite howls from Hanoi that the fillets were cheap because of naturally low costs, in other words, that was their, what's the word for that?
It's a true cost.
Their cost of production.
Competitive advantage.
Yeah. Competitive, yeah, they're right. That's the word. It's low cost, competitive advantage. Right. Commerce concluded that for the prices to be fair, duties of 37 to 67% should be applied. Chalk up another victory on the U.S. side in a dumping dispute. The U.S. side, in this instance, being Americans who raise catfish and chop them into fillets, as opposed to those who batter them, fry them, and scarf them down with rice and okra. When stiff dumping duties are slapped on imported goods, the protection that domestic producers obtain comes at the expense of consumers who lose out on the rock-bottom prices they would otherwise enjoy. The foreign exporters hit with the duties, meanwhile, are often forced to retreat from the market. That outcome isn't completely certain in the catfish case because the duties set by Commerce will remain provisional pending a decision by another federal agency on whether imports are injuring the U.S. catfish industry. But the case of certain frozen fish fillets from Vietnam offers an instructive look at how, in the arena of U.S. anti-dumping law, American industry gets a leg up on its rival from overseas. So this article is going to be talking about the unfair advantage basically, we are in a position of setting the rules, and I won't go through that part of it, but incredibly high-priced attorneys are hired to defend the case before America, the U.S. Department of Commerce, and other agencies that are involved with this regulation. But it gets complicated because what happens in this case is, and you'll see it in the next paragraph, you are really putting really low-income people in Vietnam against, you're pitting them against low-income people here in the U.S. To anyone who likes to see Washington come to the aid of downtrodden American workers, the catfish case is heartening. The duties set by Commerce are aimed at saving from possible extinction an industry that employs about 13,000 people, mostly in economically depressed areas of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Arkansas. Many of them, and this is a quote from, of course, a representative in Washington from Arkansas, who happens to be a Democrat. Many of them, mothers coming off government assistance, single moms who have never had a job before, breaking the cycle of poverty. These are the kind of arguments that are made in this case. But to those who wish the U.S. would more faithfully practice the free trade gospel, and Maury, this is where it's at, what you were talking about, that it would practice the free trade gospel that it preaches, the case is a travesty, illustrating that when it comes to industries with political clout, steel, sugar, and lumber, for example, Washington often finds a way to curtail foreign competition. Although the anti-dumping laws supposedly establish a level playing field for American and foreign firms, many economists and free trade proponents deride the laws and their enforcement as tilted in favor of domestic partners. And I won't go, when this was written, the decision was pending about what they were going to do for a variety of reasons. This was dated just the day before I left, and it says the trade ruling favors U.S. catfish farmers over Vietnamese. So then now Vietnamese catfish farmers are struggling. So that's what's going on there.
Not struggling, they're totally devastated.
They're totally, yeah.
I think the language used in the United States is completely self-serving. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what's the alternative? I mean, if we go that way, then we have areas of our country that are going to be devastated.
Well, why shouldn't some areas of this country have to struggle when the whole rest of the world has to struggle so desperately? I mean, why should only this country not have to struggle?
Tell that to those people.
Yeah.
To which people?
The people that are struggling here.
Louisiana.
Everybody. Yeah.
Tell it to the rest of the world.
But I'm saying it's a very natural reaction. Protectionism is a very natural reaction if it happens to you. You want to protect
your
own.
It's a very natural reaction of the very powerful.
I'd say the very weak.
Yeah.
Well, the unions were formed by the weak, in a sense, to protect their jobs. So, I mean, it's a very natural response if you're poor. You don't care about the guy across the street or
follow
the
money.
But I still say that it's a natural response. It might not be
exploited.
A moral thing, but
exploited.
It's a natural response.
Exploited. Follow the money. The 13,000 people who were possibly getting jobs at risk aren't the ones getting the money from that decision.
They're not the ones that benefit overwhelmingly, but their job is at stake. That's all. I'm just saying is that their job is at stake. If you go to them and say, should we be buying this versus the stuff in Vietnam, they'll say we should be buying the stuff that I'm making. Just like the American auto worker has pushed to have protectionism for American products here. I mean, it's just a very natural thing to have happen.
We could probably spend this is exciting because this is, for one thing, it keeps me from having to strain my voice. But I'd like to give you a kind of a snapshot of where the the globe, what I call the global faith community, is trying to address these issues of inequities in terms of trade and setting up, answering your question, what do we need to do given these, given if we say that free trade isn't going to work, then what are we talking about and what are we going to put in its place? And what I'd like to do is just give you a snapshot going to specific people in many different situations. And this is a wonderful, one of the organizations that has done some of the best work on trade in terms of the faith community is Christian Aid, which is a UK-based, well, it's basically a Protestant, it represents all of the Protestant denominations in the UK, and they've done a lot of work on trade. And this is from an excellent. Some of these, they've given us permission, us Lutheran World Relief, to use some of their materials, just in any way we want to use to get the word out. So we're going to be doing some of that. We don't have the kind of budget that can put out nice glossy, full-colored brochures with pictures, but I think the content of some of this is very helpful, and it will get into some of where we think the trade rules need to be going to, in order to be just and fair. And these are specific stories. First of all, country, Philippines. Since 1994, Osino Mato and the Subanon indigenous peoples of southern Philippines have been struggling to defend their land from encroachment and destruction by a Canadian mining company. They accuse the company of human rights violations and having a complete disregard for local wishes. But with the imbalance of power, there's almost nothing they can do to stop it. The Subanon people need new trade rules to regulate international companies. The rules should recognize the benefits that companies can bring, but should prevent exploitation and require them to listen to local communities. Ghana. Current trade rules encourage countries to produce export crops, often at the expense of local food production. As a result, Lydia Sosu lost her land when a local fruit company increased the size of its farm to grow fruit for export to Europe. Lydia needs new trade rules that balance the benefits of exporting with the need to produce food for local people. India. Many pork communities in India rely on local plants and traditional recipes to make their medicine. Meera, who works for the Voluntary Health Association of India, says that this is a vital resource of health care, a vital source of health care for people who don't want or can't afford Western medicine. But new international trade rules, what she's talking about, new international trade rules, she's talking about the TRIPS agreement of the WTO, that is the trade-related intellectual property agreements of the World Trade Organization. But new international trade rules will increasingly put these practices under threat. Large international companies can now buy worldwide patents that could make local manufacture and sale of medicines from those plants illegal. Meera wants new trade rules that protect poor community rights over traditional knowledge and practice. Zimbabwe. Sylvia Moyo sells chickens in an isolated part of Zimbabwe. On the face of it, it is hard to see how international trade affects her. But Sylvia believes that if her country received a better deal from international trade, she would also see the benefits. It might be that her neighbors would be able to afford more of her chickens, or that a new road would enable her to sell her chickens in the nearby town. It might be that essential medicines could be made cheaper, or new technologies enable the community to use solar power. Sylvia needs new trade rules that are written with the specific aim of helping poor and isolated communities, as well as preventing trade that is exploitative. Trade rules could also promote trade programs and activities that proactively fight poverty. Caribbean. Trouble with these things, it's hard to read. colors they choose. In 1998, the U.S. launched what became known as the Banana War at the World Trade Organization. At the behest of large U.S. companies, the U.S. government wanted the EU, the European Union, to end the assistance it gave to small-scale Caribbean banana farmers such as Nioka. The aim was to force these small-scale farmers to compete on the open market with large U.S. companies. Instead of protecting the less powerful farmers, the international trade rules actually supported the large companies, and in time the EU will have to comply. Nioka needs new trade rules which recognize that poor farmers and powerful companies sometimes need to be treated differently. Haiti. Philippe Michel works in a rice mill in Haiti. The rice mill was built so that poor rice farmers could produce their rice and sell it on local process their rice and sell it on the local markets. However, because other countries can afford to subsidize their rice, imports from these countries sell more cheaply than Haitian rice, which is making it harder and harder for Philippe to find a market. With little alternative work, the farmers and their families face a desperate situation. Philippe needs new trade rules that allow poor countries to protect their poor producers from international traders with whom they cannot hope to compete, especially when these traders are supported by subsidies from their own richer governments. And one final one from Uganda. James Musele is a coffee farmer in Uganda. Like many coffee growers around the world, he is facing a crisis. Over the last 3 years, the world price of coffee has halved. In the past, there were agreements to keep the price of coffee stable, but the last such agreement ended in 1989, and as a result, that price has fluctuated wildly. James needs new trade rules to keep the price of coffee stable so he and other poor farmers like him are not thrown from one crisis to another. That just gives you sort of an idea of the broad range of how trade rules are affecting people, especially, again, the focus is on poor people in usually impoverished communities and countries, and what some of the changes are that need to be made. Now, there are some attempts, and just let me mention, I just assume that since you're the kind of folks who come to Holden Village, that you all are selling fair Lutheran World Fair Trade coffee in your congregation, right? Okay. Well, if you aren't, if you just happen to be one of those that aren't, these are brochures about that program. It's been a very successful program in terms of numbers. The Lutherans have been leaders in this regard, but we have a long, long way to go. It isn't changing trade policies. It doesn't approach it that way, and it approaches it much differently, and it deals with. But it gets down to doing a fairly good job of making us aware of how we are spending money in our daily lives that are affecting people from other countries. But the demand for fair trade coffee has grown incredibly. In 1999, the amount of sales in this country on fair trade coffee was 2.1 million. Just 3 years later, in 2002, it had grown to 9 million, from 2.1 to 9 million.
What's the percentage of coffee that represents?
That's a good question. Not very much.
Not even a drop.
Was it a drop in the bucket.
Was that dollars you talked about?
I was talking about dollars. Okay. And so that, yeah, so into coffee is the second highest traded product in the world.
Mm-hmm. What's the first?
I think you would guess. What is
it? Military?
Oil.
Yeah. Oil is the highest. But I mean, just think, coffee comes in. A lot of people drink coffee, and basically, I mean, we can talk when we talk about the coffee crisis. The reason for the coffee crisis is basically unfair trade rules, and more importantly, the kind of push that has come from the international financial institutions when they've encouraged countries to get in the business of growing coffee as an export crop in order to generate income to pay their global debts. So you have Vietnam coming on now with coffee that is basically underselling all the rest of the coffee and basically driving coffee farmers out of business. It's, you know, one of those, another, well, I mean, that's another thing. Anyway, that's a question that's never been asked before. I don't know if I've ever seen the figures. It's a very small percentage of the coffee. But it's difficult. It's taken me 4 years. In our office suite in Washington is a suite, the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs is the main suite. They occupy most of the suite. And then the Pan-Lutheran groups, Lutheran World Relief, Lutheran Immigration Refugee Service, and Lutheran Services of America, were all there. But one of the first things that I tried to do when I came 4 years ago, you know, from Nebraska, I was all excited about coffee. I said, we got the least we can do is serve fair trade coffee.
Why do you think so?
Well, it just, you know, it's just going to be a lot more expensive.
Yeah.
And, you know, the coffee is really paid for. You aren't paying for the coffee anyway, because it's paid for out of some office in Chicago that's not even connected, it's not even out of our budget. And they pay for the coffee, and, you know, I just gave up. Well, we've had a transfer of leadership there in that office, and the first day on her job, I went in with a proposal. Now is the time. It was a no-brainer for her. We're serving fair trade coffee now. Well, so I mean that, but I mean here we are, a Lutheran organization, but not even doing it. But to give you an idea of where we have to go, all right, there are about 2,700 Lutheran congregations that are serving fair trade coffee, that are ordering and serving it. But do you know how many? And my Lutheran, I'm combining we're talking about the ELCA and LCMS and Wisconsin Synod, probably. Whatever other small groups and Lutherans that might be out there are not part of that. But we're looking at a potential of 17,000 congregations. So there's a long, long way to go, even in terms of... But I'm not in the business of... There's another department that's... Jonathan Frerichs, who just got here yesterday, he's the head of communications, and he has people in his staff that are working with the Fair Trade Coffee Program, and we actually got a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation of $100,000 to promote and to other denominations the Fair Trade Coffee Program. So a lot of other denominations are picking this up over a three-year period, and the intention is to grow it even beyond that. I see this as an opportunity because I work on the advocacy side of things to raise the whole issue of fair trade in terms of education with the intention of hoping to change some of these other trade rules. In that regard, let me just mention some resources that...
How do you guarantee that if you change the trade rules, that not the powerful will be overwhelming, they will benefit? As far as if you put in something to protect the lowly farmer, that basically the big corporation who's got the resources figures out how to get that protection.
You aren't guaranteed that. I mean, you're up against, it's a David and Goliath kind of story. But
without the rules, you're guaranteed.
Yeah.
That Goliath is going to win.
Right.
I know. I'm just saying.
So
it's everything.
Why not have a 20-80 versus a 100-0?
Yeah.
I think.
Kind of set of rules.
Part of it is empowering people at the local level. I mean, they're up against some tremendous obstacles here, but a lot of it has to do with transparency. A lot of these trade rules were developed behind closed doors, and even in the last few years, that process has opened up. So these meetings, they aren't to where we would like them to be, but a lot of the decisions and a lot of the rules that are made, you know, it's the power is very unequal, the power from one country to the other. Countries have to accept these trade rules. Just to give you an example, a lot of these meetings that take place with countries' finance ministers around trade issues take place in Geneva. And we have an office, I mean, we, the United States has an office there that's, I mean, I don't know how many people are in that office. I mean, there are probably 50 people over there, I mean, maybe even more. Some of these countries, they can't even afford to have people at the meetings. They don't have the resources to have people to even go to the meetings. So if the poor countries are unrepresented in terms of numbers of people, just voices, there when these decisions are being made, I mean, that's just, they aren't even present. And even when they're present, I mean, the transparency is such that civil society, what we call civil society, people who are sort of the watchdogs, don't even have access. That's changed a lot within the last, I would say, last three to four years, because we have become aware of how these decisions are made. It's been very difficult to penetrate the closed doors and the meetings that are happening, but it's beginning to be more of an open process.
I'm trying to remember what the meeting was in Seattle that had such a large demonstration about. But that was, I think, an example of what you mean, that people are starting to figure out where these decisions are being made and attempting in a fairly modest way to exert some influence, where in the past that meeting would have happened and none of us would have ever heard of it, I think.
That really put it on the map, but of course the response to that has been to hold meetings that are completely inaccessible.
Yeah, they've gone underground again.
It's sort of like they've gone underground. Let me, I know, just mention two more things, and then, because I don't want to forget that, I made some copies of an example of how we are doing advocacy relating to trade issues. This is one of the networks in Washington, is the Africa Advocacy Network, or the Advocacy Network for Africa, ADNA it's called. About 200 organizations are a member of that. We participate in it. This is an example of a letter that was sent. It's an old letter now, back going back to December, but it's addressed to Robert Zelnick, who is the U.S. Trade Representative, who basically is the one who goes and negotiates a lot of these things. But I just wanted you to see the kind of things that are raised in not only the letters, but this also represents follow-up meetings. It's chipping away at it, but it raises some of the important issues. The other thing is, this is what I'm really, I hope that all of you, I think there's enough for all of you. I've been a part of an interfaith working group on trade and investment that just formed shortly after I came to Washington 4 years ago. It was an interfaith group rather than an ecumenical group, although in reality it's mostly Christian. And we had one Jewish organization that's been a part of the dialogue, but we want to make it more of an interfaith process. But we basically prepared a statement on international trade and investment that, if I had more time, I would like to go over this with you, because it deals with basically five principles of trade that we have are saying needs to be part of any kind of economic system. So I just wanted to mention this so you pick that up as well. Now we can maybe answer some more questions. Yes?
I'd like to say something about the catfish situation.
Yeah.
It seems to me to capture the situation quite well, because it's pictures of pitting 13,000 Americans against 1.3 million, let's use an order factor of 100.
Yeah.
That gives some for the number of people who are living on the, just for catfish. Mm. And yet it seems okay to vote to support the 13,000 US people at the expense of the 1.3 million people who don't happen to be U.S. And so my question is, What are we going to do differently tomorrow than we did today because now we know this? That's I mean, are we just going to go, oh, yeah, it's too bad, go back to Walmart?
Well, let's talk about how do you solve that? Let's use that as sort of a case study, knowing what we do, which is what you said. What would be a just solution to the? I mean, granted, we don't know all of the pieces of it, but just from what you've heard and what's been told you, what would be a just response to this dilemma?
It's too bad that outside of the government role, we couldn't just create a market for the fair trade catfish. As consumers have awareness of, you know, whether pesticides are used in their products, they want organic vegetables, and so they'll pay more for organic vegetables. And if we could create in the marketplace an awareness of what you're supporting if you were to buy fair trade, you know, clothing or coffee or catfish, you could empower consumers at a local level to help put their money where their beliefs are, and, you know, kind of not having to go through the government politics to do that as much.
Okay, solution.
But do we already put our money where our stated convictions are?
I would say in the market we live in, we live in Texas, in an area where you would never have an opportunity or an option, or you wouldn't even see this in the marketplace reflected. And to have, you know, if our stores, we have, you know, grocery stores that are going to buy what, you know, if they know we want free-range chicken, they'll put free-range chicken in. If they knew we wanted free-range catfish, if we were to speak up, or whatever.
That's a new delicacy.
That's not even an option in the marketplace where we are right now.
Maybe we need to work through our advocacy to change the structural adjustment policies of the World Bank and the IMF, which probably created the situation where they had to start farming catfish for export crops anyway, so that more of those governments' monies can go into health services, social services, education. People won't be forced to grow for export, and then maybe they can internally take care of their own a little bit better. Mm-hmm.
Okay, other ideas come floating up?
Just a question. I mean, we're talking about the either or here. Surely there's some kind of halfway medium place where we don't have to abandon 13,000 Americans who are hardworking poor people to help the million. I mean, isn't there some ground in between this? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, well, one of the arguments that has been made is that when there is that kind of displacement of providing alternative work training for new jobs or whatever it is. I mean, a lot of times the jobs are in depressed areas, but usually the large companies haven't been held accountable or responsible for that. It usually falls on the back of, you know, government programs or community colleges or whatever else. So it comes sort of out of the source of it comes out of the general public. And in some places, companies need to be held more accountable for the kind of displacement that occurs. For example, if they come in and take land away from to grow fruit in the whatever country it was here, that there will be other land provided somewhere. But that kind of displacement, if you read about anything, the problem is the problem of scale, too. I mean, and the difficulty is that transnational companies operate so independently. They have so much power. I've seen figures where I think they have, I don't know, like the 10 or 20 largest transnational companies have more financial resources than I don't know how many of the world's countries. I can't come up with those figures, but it's and nobody knows how to hold them accountable. Because we, you know, in the advocacy community, we've done a pretty good job over the years of figuring out how decisions are being made in, at the government level. We know who's, if something isn't working right, we know whose door to knock on, what senator or what representative, or if it's commerce or agriculture, we know how to open those doors. We don't really know how to get access to or how decisions are made within the transnational corporations that exist. We're sort of picking around the edges. We have shareholder resolutions. It's not that we aren't trying. One of the issues I have worked on is the whole issue of the Lutheran Board of Pensions holding, I think, 100,000 shares of Talisman Oil. A company that was doing business in Sudan, where there were tremendous human, have been and still are, tremendous human rights violations. We were pretty much unsuccessful. I mean, we tried, and there were several attempts. What happened? It was a Canadian company, but the shares were sold on the U.S. market. And even though there were, It's a long story to tell, but what happened? The Canadian oil company sold their shares to Talisman. So the oil then is being, and their argument was, well, wouldn't you rather deal with us? We're the good guys. If we sell our shares, then you'll have to deal with the Chinese or the other companies that are doing, and then you won't have access to them. And that's exactly what has happened. They've basically sold their shares, washed their hands of the situation, although you sometimes wonder if they are, you know, who knows about how these agreements and offshore companies are holding their pot. Yes?
Well, I have a small thing, a little issue on that. Did Talisman ever bring any good to the people? You're saying no, or you just don't agree with the politics of the government, and therefore you want the company out regardless if they brought good to the goodwill and benefits to the people?
No, there was, I mean, they said that they did. But all the documentation I've seen, and the documentation has been very extensive in that case. There was very little they could. I mean, it wasn't that they could have done anything. It was pretty difficult to do anything because of the power of the government over those oil companies. But they would come in and basically wipe out whole villages of people where they wanted to drill oil, and that's how they got into the areas where they wanted to drill. I mean, my file is full of letters of exchange from the president of Talisman and other who are sort of saying, we're the good guys, don't be so hard on us. And I mean, they were better than some of the other oil companies, there's no question about it. But we had access to them because
were they better than the government? Were they better than the Sudanese government?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So they were better than the Sudanese government. They could have brought benefits. They might have been bringing benefits to the people.
But they weren't.
Pardon?
But there were no benefits at all.
That was correct.
Oh, virtually none.
Not to the people.
Virtually none.
Virtually none.
I'll say none. Let's say none.
I think you have to be careful about that.
I'm right here saying it was none.
Well.
Okay. So let's go with that. Let's go with that scenario. Because the difference between what they were doing and none, you can't get out to the decimal point to find it.
Well, I've seen other cases where the politics of the government are wrong. People don't like the politics. Great. But what they'll do is they'll actually, sacrifice benefits to the people to try to get companies out because they don't agree with the politics of the company and the country. Is that a good thing to do? Is that a moral thing to do?
Those are ethical dilemmas. And the dilemma we have here is
but at the end of the day, there was no oil left. I mean, the oil was gone. There was no benefit. So who had gained? The Canadian companies and the American shareholders.
You mean there was no more oil in Sudan?
Taken to its logical conclusion, I mean, there were no benefits flowing to the people.
Well, you know, I have an example. I work for an oil company. I work for an oil company, and we're in the middle of a thing like this in Myanmar.
In where?
In Myanmar, in Burma. And I think our company has done a reasonable thing. We're also in business with Total, which is a French company, and they don't have the constraints on us, on them, as we have on us. But, you know, we've got lawsuits against us to get us out of there because of the government. It's a very bad government, okay? But we brought, I think, tremendous benefits to the people with schools and things like this. If they weren't there, those people wouldn't be employed. Now you're having a trade-off, okay? Yes, the despotic government has benefited, but the people have also. If you pull out, yes, you put pressure on the despotic government, but you might end up with people that are starving, that have no schooling, no medical, things like that. Is that a good thing?
If it was fair traded oil.
I'm not sure it's called fair trade. I mean, it's just, it is a company making an investment in another country. And
I'm not, well, I am rushing off because I'm supposed to go up, catch the bus to Stehekin today. And I feel kind of badly about it. I mean, it looks like I'm running away from people. I mean, gee, it's just nice to have people sit here and want to talk about these issues, because these are very important. These are very important issues that we're dealing with. And it seems to me that the faith community needs to be front and center, struggling with these issues. The answers are not easy. And I think in all of these, it's sometimes easy to rush to conclusion. It's very easy to polarize. It's so difficult to get people together to just sort of sit down and say, well, this is, you know, just engage in some of the ethical questions that we have. And it's not just an exercise, because people's lives are at stake and the welfare of people all over the world is being affected by these decisions. Public policies do make a difference, and they can be changed because they're created by people and they can be changed by people. So part of it is just sort of getting empowering people, I think, to become involved in at whatever level they have access to the system. And we're all privileged to be part of a system that supposedly gives us power. We just aren't exercising it very well at the ballot box. So, given that little sermon, please pick up these things, help yourself. Thank you.